Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. And Howard, we are going to do something unusual today. We are going to talk about the positive things going on in the NBA right now. That's right. We are going to talk about the Milwaukee Bucks. We are going to talk about the Utah Jazz. We are going to talk about the Cleveland Cavaliers, which might be a championship-level team this season with Donovan Mitchell on board. No Brooklyn Nets talk, no negativity. We are going largely positive on this show today, Howard.
Not even like 30 seconds of Laker bashing or.
Yeah, we do have to do it. I will say we do have to do that only because I have a column up on the Lakers on SI.com. So I do want to.
Well, it is important to plug our own work first. Yes, so, yes. You know. I wrote twice on the Nets last week, first on Kyrie's stuff, and then, of course, just the idea. I believe they need to just blow this thing up now. You're writing on the Lakers again. We've covered it. So we've covered the tragedy of the NBA season in print. People can find it on SI now or at SI.com. Let's have a nice, positive, uplifting podcast about teams that know how to play basketball.
I mean, lost in the Laker drama and the Nets dysfunction is that there are some pretty good stories this year.
Absolutely.
In the NBA, and we're going to get into several of them on the show. I do want to kick it off, though, to just touch briefly on the Lakers. They lost to Utah last night. Second time in three nights they've lost to the Jazz. Gave up 139 points in that game. No LeBron, no Patrick Beverley, no Lonnie Walker, though I don't think it would have mattered in a game like this where the defense just completely disappeared. The third quarters continue to kill the Lakers. They got 39 points in the third quarter to the Jazz, and that was the ball game right there. They are now 2-8 on the season, Howard. 10 games into the season officially. Look, I've watched almost all their games this season, whether it's in person or watching them on TV. They need to do something. It's clear. That's clear. But it's getting less and less clear that there's a deal that can be made that will make them a legitimate contender. And if that deal is not available, do you swap away those two first-round picks and a Miles Turner, Buddy Hield package? Turner and Hield last night played great. Like they had, if the Lakers front office was, you know, at some point turned off its game and turned on Bally Sports out in Indiana. They got a pretty good show. Miles Turner had 37 points. Buddy Hield had 20. Turner and Hield combined for 9 3-pointers. So they kind of tickled the Lakers' sweet spot there with how they played on Monday. But I'm not sure either that Hield and Turner all of a sudden make the Lakers a title contender. Better, yes, a title contender, I don't know. And then you have to balance, do you swap away those two first-round picks? I mean, is there, I guess I'll frame it this way. What do you do if you're the Lakers right now? Things are bad. It doesn't look like they're getting better. I don't believe Dennis Schroeder returning is going to be that impactful. I don't believe Thomas Bryant returning is going to be that impactful. What do you do if you're Rob Pelinka, Jeannie Buss, and the Lakers front office?
You mentioned Miles Turner. Let me just hit something real quick with Miles Turner, because he's been a fascinating player from the moment he arrived when he was drafted however many years ago, as like who looked like this prototype for the modern center, right? On the one end of the court, a fantastic shot blocker. Just, he calls himself the best shot blocker in the league, and when he's at his best, he is. And then at the other end, he can shoot threes, so he can draw defenses away as a big man. Like, there's so much about Miles Turner that should be great. You mentioned, so he goes for 37 and 12 with three blocks last night. The game before that, 16 and 7, it's fine. Game before that, 7 and 5. Before that, 27 and 10. Before that, 5 and 6. And before that, had four games when he was injured. Like, this is Miles Turner's career, and this is why if there's hesitation on the part of the Lakers, you could kind of understand this, or with anybody, which is that Miles Turner's all over the board. There are nights that dude is just dominant, and then there are nights that he's way too into his own shot. He's way too into his own game, and then the numbers, the efficiency is terrible. He'll be in single digits in rebounds, and then he's always hurt too. And so, like, the first 10 games of the season for the Pacers, you've seen the full gamut of the Miles Turner experience. I still think he's in the right place, and the Lakers would be the right place. I think he'd be a good player for them. And I still say it's the wrong standard to say that they need to make a deal that makes them contenders this season. They're not going to be contenders this season, period. You got to make a deal that makes you relevant and makes you a playoff team, because otherwise you're just wasting a season of LeBron's career. And if you're counting on free agency to fix everything next summer, you're fooling yourself. So the sooner that they commit to a direction, the better. I will add one thing without going into all the detail, but I was canvassing a bunch of front office folks last week while talking to people, vetting my idea, workshopping my idea about, can the Nets just tear down now? Should they tear down now? What could they reasonably get for Kevin Durant? Could they get anything for Kyrie Irving? Could they get anything at all for Ben Simmons? And in those discussions, when I brought up the Lakers, the pushback I was getting was they're waiting for a specific player. They're not, that they're not doing the Pacer deal, that they're not doing, that they wouldn't probably do now the Kyrie deal that we thought for sure they would do a couple months ago, is an indication that the Lakers are waiting for a bigger fish, a bigger piece to come loose that they think they can trade Westbrook and the two future firsts for.
Who do you think that is? Like, I don't know who that is.
I'll tell you offline.
Okay. All right. Well, all right. I put it this way. I don't know that the player, whoever that is, the Lakers may be targeting, would be acquirable for what they're willing to give up.
I don't think so either, by the way.
That's the...
I don't think a Westbrook at this stage of his career plus two future firsts equals a difference maker at that level, somebody who's going to make you a contender, which is why, again, getting two players who are good, solid, upper-tier starters, maybe not all-stars, but starters who fill positions. Like, the Lakers rotation is filled with guys who are either starters who should be reserves, reserves who should be 14th men, 14th men who should be G-leaguers. Like, this is the problem. They just have nothing. So getting two high-quality starters in Hield and Turner, to me, again, is fine. That is enough. It makes you relevant this season. It maybe gets you to the playoffs, and then you can work next summer to try to fortify that group.
And look, it's a risk because Turner's going to be a free agent at the end of the year. You'd have to pay him a premium to re-sign him. By bringing in Buddy Hield, you gobble up a lot of your available cap space for next summer. Not that there was this marquee free agent that you were sure you're going to be able to get next offseason. I understand all the risks involved, but I look at Miles Turner and all the warts to his game notwithstanding, he'd fit pretty well opposite Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis talked last night again about the adjustment he has playing center. It's pretty obvious Davis does not want to be a full-time five. He likes being a four because it's not as physically taxing. He likes being a four because it can allow him to roam more on the defensive side of the ball and be more of a weak side shot blocker instead of grappling with a big man in the post. Turner could do that. And on top of that, he's someone that shoots threes as well. So I don't believe, to use an old phrase, the Lakers should let the pursuit of perfection kind of block them from doing something good here. Like, they need to do something to change things up because this season is slipping away. I mean, the defense that we thought was going to be a positive for them has completely collapsed over the last three games. They're giving up 127 points per game over those last three, and two of those games have been played against Utah. If not for a miracle Matt Ryan shot a week ago, they would have lost to the Brandon Ingram-less, Herb Jones-less New Orleans Pelicans. They very easily could be 1-9 as we're sitting here. So something's got to give because I don't see any. I appreciate Darvin Ham's optimism, and he's given a lot of these "it's always dark before the dawn" type of speeches. I appreciate that, but I don't see this thing turning around without a roster change. I just don't see it at all. All right, let's talk about the team that the Lakers played last night. The number one team in the Western Conference right now, my Utah Jazz, Howard. The Utah Jazz are 9-3 to start the season. There has to have been somebody out there in Vegas that predicted the Jazz or bet on the Jazz to win 9 of their first 12. They are very rich men or women at the moment because this has been a ridiculous start from Milwaukee. Utah has a top 10 offense. They have a top 15 defense. They have a 22-point-per-game score in Lauri Markkanen, and they effectively have a 10-man rotation of guys playing at least 14 minutes per game. I asked this question on Twitter last week, so I'll ask you now. When are we ready to say that this Jazz team is a legitimate threat to make the playoffs?
I would say we need to wait until, I'm going to say January 15th. I know it's a long way off. I'm not saying I'm skeptical.
That's past the midseason point. That's past the midseason
right.
point.
Maybe even we could say January 5th, whatever. But like early January. And the reason why is this. It's not that I'm skeptical, Chris, of the idea that this team has discovered, possibly quite by accident, a certain chemistry and style of play that has made them very successful early in the season. It's been fun. It's been inspiring. It has especially been fun because it runs entirely counter to the idea that they were blowing it up in order to be in the Victor Wembanyama sweepstakes, that they were tanking for lottery balls and all this stuff. They traded away their two best players, two all-stars, two perennial all-stars, two of the top 20 guys in the NBA. They traded away for role players and picks, and they're doing what they're doing. So it's not that I'm skeptical that sometimes you can be a phenomenal ensemble with no stars, better than the sum of your parts, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm not prepared to call Lauri Markkanen an all-star yet. I'm sorry. It's not about that. They might sustain this level of play, Chris. What I'm waiting on is not whether the Jazz success is real and sustainable. I think it possibly is. I'm a little skeptical because talent in this league always wins out. Almost always wins out. And they just don't have enough high-level talent, right? So eventually you expect some regression to the mean. But that's not what I'm waiting for. I'm not waiting for them to regress to the mean playing-wise. I'm waiting to see whether your buddy Danny Ainge and Justin Zanuck and the rest of that front office and the new owner, new-ish, see this and go, wow, well, this is fun, but guys, this is not going to be our team for the next 3 to 5 years, and this is not a team that's going to make a finals run ever. Shouldn't we be tanking for Victor Wembanyama? I mean, if you don't think that that discussion's happening in their front office and at the ownership level there every single day, you are deluding yourself. I know this is fun. I know it's unexpected. I know that the platonic ideal in this league is everybody should try to win all the time, and this is good, and tearing down a team that's having success is immoral. I get that. Fine. In a vacuum, fine. For this season, yes. But you're not about one season as a front office, as a franchise. You have to plan for a 3 to 5 year window at minimum. And what's your best path over the next 3 to 5 years? Keeping together this team to top out at 47, 48 wins per year, get knocked out in the first round every year, maybe get to the second round, maybe. Because there's not, you know, Lauri Markkanen's all-star-ish type start notwithstanding, tell me who in this roster is going to be a perennial all-star. I don't see one. And Mike Conley's on borrowed time at his age. So he's not going to be around past the 3 to 5 year window that I'm talking about. So what are you built on? What is your plan beyond the season? Like, okay, great. This is a classic, we're getting drunk on some unexpected success and the hangover is going to last you the next 5 years after that when you miss out on potential franchise changing stars like Victor Wembanyama and Scoot Henderson. So, that's what I'm waiting on, Chris. I want to know which day they say, you know what, we got to pull the plug. Trade Lauri Markkanen has never been worth more in his entire career since the day he was drafted, I think, 7th overall several years ago. Trade him now at the peak of his value and let this team plummet the way we all thought they were going to anyway. I hate to say that. I don't relish that for Jazz fans because this is fun. But your obligation is to plan for multiple years, not just to ride the wave of one season at the expense of being able to do anything else. And by the way, one other quick thing, because I got a little pushback on Twitter yesterday after I said this on somebody else's podcast. I understand they have other tools at their disposal. They will have cap room. They already have a boatload of picks. That's no guarantee either. And still, you do not want to eliminate yourself from the possibility of a generational type talent like Victor Wembanyama, and there's no guarantee you get him with a 14% chance with a top bottom three record, blah, blah, blah. I get all that. You have to put yourself in the running when you're in this position.
I mostly agree with that. Look, I don't think that the front office's position on trading its vets have changed. I think Mike Conley is still very much available. I think Jordan Clarkson, who has been fantastic, is very much available. Lauri Markkanen, I don't know. I mean, you're right. His value probably has never been higher, but he is 25 years old, and at some point you're going to want guys to play around Victor Wembanyama if you do get him, sure, or Scoot Henderson, whoever. So I'm not sure Lauri Markkanen, that they'd be so quick to trade him at the moment. But I think all the guys that you thought were available before the season are still currently available. I just want to just dive into for a minute why the Jazz are playing so well. You mentioned Markkanen. He has been absolutely outstanding, averaging 22 points per game on just about 16 shots per game. He's shooting 51% from the floor. That includes 7 of his attempts coming from 3, where he still isn't very good. He's creating mismatches offensively. He's been a solid rim protector defensively. And he can get even better. I mentioned the 3-point shooting. He's shooting below 30% from 3, which is well below.
Which is wild. Wild.
Yeah, which is wild.
Because he's a good three-point shooter.
Exactly. Last two seasons, I think he was 35% last year, 36%, 40% the year before. Yeah. When that number goes up, Lauri Markkanen's going to be an even better scorer for this team. I mentioned the depth. One of the benefits of not having a star-heavy roster is that there's not a lot of drop-off when you go to the bench. They have 6 guys right now averaging in double figures. Jared Vanderbilt is about a point away from double figures. You go from Jordan Clarkson and Mike Conley to Colin Sexton and Talen Horton-Tucker, and there really isn't a massive drop-off. You can play the same way for 48 minutes a game, and I think there's a benefit to that. You'd certainly love to have Kevin Durant or LeBron James or Anthony Davis or somebody of that caliber, but when you don't have them, you can just basically send guys out in waves and not really lose much when you make that many changes. Last part of this is Will Hardy. I was listening to Darvin Ham's press conference last night, and in between kind of his reaction to the Lakers side of it, he did mention the Jazz and how they play and how they're just in action after action after action. They just keep moving, and they keep going into different types of actions. They never stop playing their style, and that's a credit to Will Hardy. He's got this team attacking offensively, they rank in the top 10 in the league in shots at the rim and are shooting above 60% when they get there. In clutch situations, I saw this stat, Howard, which is defined as being within 5 points in the last 5 minutes of the game. Utah has an offensive rating of, 106, I think, and is 5-2 in those games. So you watch them play, and they play with a high, high energy. They're not a team of a bunch of great defenders, but they're just flying around out there and playing at a ridiculous level on that end of the floor as well, at least above their heads on that end of the floor. So I don't disagree with you that we're going to see more pieces moved out of Utah. Conley, Clarkson, Kelly Olynyk is probably a player too that could be had at this point. But as long as this group is together, I think there is a measure of sustainability to what they're doing. I don't think there's going to be a big cliff that they fall off in the next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They might lose some games, probably will lose some games. But as long as this roster is put together, they're at the minimum a candidate to finish 500. And if you finish 500 in the Western Conference, you got a pretty good chance of winding up in that play-in mix at the very least.
Yeah, I had jotted down three questions I had about the Jazz and about just this start and where it goes. The first one is what Lauri Markkanen is doing sustainable. He's never done this in his career. He's never been a leading man on his team. He's never been the guy that everything kind of is built around, and that's kind of de facto what he is right now for that team. Now, it is an ensemble approach, but he is by far their leading scorer, and it's by far his career highs in almost everything. Career high scoring, career high assists, career high rebounds, career high free throw attempts, field goal attempts, true shooting percentage. The only thing he's not doing at a career high rate is the career low 3-point percentage, which, as you said, and I agree, will probably go up. So he'll only improve there. But everything else, you wonder if it'll come down a little because he's never done it at this level before. Now, guys bloom at all different stages of a career. It's possible. It's the first time, if you want to go by one of the all-in-one stats by PER, this is the first time he's ever been over 20. So PER, the way that John Hollinger created PER is that if you have a PER of 15, that's the league average. Always, always, always 15 is the league average in any given season for anybody. But so below 15 is below league average, and above 15, if you're at 16, 17, yeah, you're good, you're decent, you're a little. So 20 is a pretty good measure, and he's at 22 last time I checked, Markkanen. He's never been at that tier in his career. So again, I think a little bit of let's wait and see how well he can sustain this is fair to say. The second question is, are they, when we say playoff team, so now the top six in this modern era with the play-in tournament, the top six are the guaranteed playoff teams. So here's a question to ask. We don't have to answer on all these, but are the Jazz really better than Memphis, Denver, Dallas, New Orleans, the Clippers? I know the Clippers are really weird right now. The Warriors, I know the Warriors are really weird right now. The Suns. So that's like seven teams that I think should be better than the Jazz on paper and track record alone, depending on which team we're talking about. So, and yeah, look, we've got some weird stuff going on, right? Like the Warriors are just kind of dragging, and the Clippers, I don't know what the hell is going on with Kawhi Leonard. Mavericks certainly have issues beyond Luka. But still, those are all teams that should be ahead of the Jazz. And then the third question was, is this the one we already covered, which is this what the Jazz really want? And I don't think this is what the Jazz really want. I think they would rather be in the lottery. They blew up this team for a reason. And I'm not saying that they blew it up just for Wembanyama. They blew it up because they'd reached a plateau with Mitchell and Gobert as their core, and it was time to try something new. That it happened to come at the same time as a generational talent in the draft might be less than coincidence. More than coincidence. It's at some point they've got to decide what their best path is for the long term, not just for what happens this season.
Yeah, I get it. I've said this before. It does remind me a little of the 12-13 season in Boston. This was after they made the deals that sent Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett out. They traded Rajon Rondo early in that season. That was a team that I think Danny Ainge expected to bottom out. It didn't. And that was in part because they had a really good coach in Brad Stevens. They had players that played kind of above their heads. They were still a lottery team, but they weren't one of the worst teams in basketball, which is what I think the Celtics projected them to be at that time.
Yeah, and we've had a couple examples of this over the years, especially during this, what I would call the tanking era since the Sixers started the process, when we've been really fixated on this. But the same year that the Sixers were in that tanking era, one of them, the 13-14 season, that was when the Suns were supposedly tanking, and they ended up winning 48 games with an ensemble cast, just missed the playoffs because the Mavericks were the eighth seed that year at 49 wins. An eighth seed with 49 wins is insane. So the Suns, in any normal year, would have even made the playoffs, but that was supposedly a tanking team. But they had this amazing chemistry. They loved playing for each other, playing together, and they overachieved by a lot, but that they still were only the ninth best team that year. And this Jazz team, again, same kind of thing, where it's like they're going to top out in the mid-40s in wins if they kept this together. I don't think this is really the trajectory that you should expect. And I think based on that Suns example, and maybe even the Celtics example you raise, that's why if you're the Jazz, especially if you're Danny Ainge, who lived through that Boston example you just mentioned, you look at this and go, yeah, guys, we need to either come up with some injuries for guys or start trading some of these players who are ruining our lottery chances.
Crazy. Never would have expected the Jazz to start 9-3 on the season, be the top team in the Western Conference as we sit here on Election Day. It's just unbelievable. All right, let's talk about Milwaukee, the best team in the NBA right now. 9-1 after the loss to Atlanta on Monday. That was their third game in four nights. Understandable that they struggled in the second half of that one. Giannis is putting up MVP numbers, Howard. Jrue Holiday's putting up all-star numbers. They have the number one defense in the NBA, and they have done all this while Chris Middleton has played exactly 0 minutes for them this season. Howard, we've talked about the parity in the NBA, but is Milwaukee right now on or in a tier all to their own?
They are. And by the way, when you mention Middleton hasn't played yet, yes, a really important factor here. Chris Middleton, you know, great scorer, great shooter, defender, everything. They'll be better when he gets back. But he's not even the only significant piece they're missing, because Pat Connaughton hasn't played and Joe Ingles hasn't played. And the reason I bring up those guys also, they're not obviously at Middleton's level, but think of how deep the rotation is. And by the way, think about how much shooting that is. Chris Middleton is a 39% career three-point shooter. Connaughton, career 36%. Ingles, career 41%. Not to mention Joe Ingles, really good playmaker, great with the ball in his hands, and another guy who, you know, between him and Middleton and Giannis and Jrue Holiday, like, that's a bunch of guys who can do something with the ball in their hands, make plays, get other guys open. They're going to be even better. The Bucks are going to be even better. And they just suffered their first loss last night. Interestingly, so they've got by far the number one defense in the NBA. They're like 3 points per 100 possessions better than Cleveland, who's number two. And a huge leap from last year. They were 14th in defense last season, which actually surprised me. I thought they would have been better. They're up to they are number one by a lot. They're only 18th in offense right now. And that's a big plummet from last season when they were third overall. So the offense should get better. If I were going to, you know, play Milwaukee Grinch here for a minute, Chris, Giannis's usage rate is through the freaking roof. And it's paying off for them. It's paying dividends. And maybe it's partially out of necessity because of the absence of Middleton. When he gets back, things will come back to a little more equilibrium. But even in this era of these do-everything, high-usage players like Harden during his Houston years and Russ during his Oklahoma years and Luka in Dallas, this is still like almost a historic outlier. I looked it up real quick. So Giannis's usage rate, which is at 38, so it means he's using 38% of all possessions, 38% of all the possessions he's on the floor, he is either shooting, going to the line, or committing a turnover. 38 usage would be the seventh highest ever. One of the ones that's ahead of him is Luka, also this season at 39. The only other guys in history who have had that usage rate through a full season, the highest ever was Westbrook in 2016-17. That Oklahoma team finished with 47 wins. Then there was a Harden season in Houston where they finished with 53 wins, but they lost in the second round. There's a Kobe season in 05-06, 45 wins, lost in the first round. another rust season in Oklahoma, 2014-15, they won 45 games, did not make the playoffs. That was the year that Durant was out most of the season with an injury. And then Michael Jordan, way back in 86-87, that Bulls team won only 40 games and lost in the first round to your Boston Celtics, Chris. That's it. When you have a super incredible high usage player during the regular season, you generally speaking top out and don't have a lot of sustainability. Now, Giannis is a whole other different commodity, but there's sometimes a drawback to having one guy doing so much. I don't want to go overboard here. It's so early in the season, but it's an interesting footnote to this is that Giannis is doing more than he ever has. I don't know that you want to be burning him out in November and December. I don't know this is the kind of approach you want. I'm sure Budenholzer would rather have a little bit more balance in the offense, and maybe that happens when Middleton returns.
Well, that's the thing. That's why I'm not going to get too concerned about Giannis's usage rate, because help is on the way. I mean, when Chris Middleton comes back, he will become the second best player in that lineup, or at least the second best scorer in that lineup, and take a lot of pressure off of Giannis. Pat Connaughton has played a significant role with this team over the last few years. Joe Ingles hasn't been on this team, but I think you and I would both agree his skill set kind of fits with what they need.
Plug and play.
Playmaking, plug and play guy, exactly. Love that phrase. He's a good ball handler, good shooter, doesn't need to be overly involved to make an impact on the team. And those guys coming back into the mix are going to take a lot of pressure off Giannis. And I think in the coming months, you're going to see that usage rate, you know, tick down. So I'm not concerned about that. What makes me bullish on the Bucks right now is that defense, because I think that defense is sustainable. You look around the Bucks roster, they've got a whole bunch of elite defensive players. You've got Giannis, who's in that defensive player of the year mix every single year. Jrue Holiday, one of the best defensive players at his position. Brooke Lopez. It's 2022, and Brooke Lopez is still like one of the best players on his team. That's remarkable given where Brooke Lopez started back in 2008, all the things he's gone through, and here he is in 2022 playing at a high level and making an impact. Brooke Lopez only played, 13 games last year because of the back injury. You can see the impact that Brooke Lopez makes on the floor. Like, even when he's not producing or putting up numbers, he's boxing out and is well known to be one of the best box out guys in the NBA. He leads the league right now in contested shots. So he's getting out there, flying around, making contests for guys coming to the rim. He's spacing the floor offensively exceptionally well. Brooke Lopez is almost as important to this team's success as the Bucks' top two guys. Maybe he's just as important as guys like Holiday and Middleton are. Outside of Giannis, there might not be a more important player than Brooke Lopez. His presence makes them an absolutely dominant defensive team. And as long as he's able to stay healthy, which is always going to be the question with Lopez, they're going to be playing defense at this level. And if they play defense at this level, hard to find a team out there that's going to beat them in the playoffs.
Yeah, look, we came into the season saying that the top tier of the East was basically two teams, Milwaukee and Boston. And I don't know how you're feeling about your Celtics right now, but the Bucks and the Celtics, you know, that gap seems a little bit more right now, but not, I mean, it's look, we're going to have ups and downs over the course of this season. The Bucks will have their struggles at some point, probably, you know, everybody gets injuries at some point. Celtics have been pretty good. I still think it's at minimum a two team race. You know, we're looking at a really strange tier at the top here. We're going to get into the Cavs, I think, still on this episode.
Yep.
But, Milwaukee, you know, the Cleveland has to at least be mentioned right now. Brooklyn, I think we can safely say, has taken themselves out of this conversation entirely, if they were ever really in it. I thought they were. I was clearly mistaken. I think the Sixers will still have something to say once they get healthy and get in a better rhythm with each other. If anybody doubts that, I don't blame you. The Sixers early part of the season has been bumpy, to say the least. But you know, that's a team that, based on talent alone, I think you got to give them a little time.
Can I, you covered Brooke Lopez in New York. Does it surprise you that Brooke Lopez is this important to a championship
yes.
team right now?
listen, two things. So I didn't cover the Nets on a daily basis. I covered them for like 3 or 4 months during that exhilarating Darren Williams, Joe Johnson, Brooke Lopez era when they first got to Brooklyn. But yeah, I saw Brooke Lopez a fair amount over the years here. Two things. One, he had foot injuries and foot surgeries that at his size at one point in time were considered like a career death knell. And there was a thought that like there was a point in time there where the question was, how much should the Nets be paying him? How much should they keep extending him? Cause he's going to be untradeable because of the foot and other teams. There's no way you can move that contract if you ever need to. And what would his market value even be? He was also going to be before the foot injury, the linchpin to the Dwight Howard deal that they were supposedly going to make before Dwight Howard decided to, what was the opt-out or the opt-in in Orlando that screwed up the whole thing. But they were going to get Dwight Howard and Dwight's prime. That was the plan, and Brooke Lopez was part of a linchpin to that deal. But the two things that you would think would have cast doubt on the idea that all these years later he'd be this important and this good, the foot and the fact that he was this plodding, kind of old-school center. Brooke Lopez didn't start becoming a three-point shooter until very late in his career. And was a guy who didn't have the mobility to defend away from the basket. And he's become a really good defender. He's still not a guy, obviously, who's going to chase guys around screens or anything. But, he's great, and obviously, in their drop coverages. And he's a little bit more mobile than given credit. And he shoots the three really well. So he's evolved and adapted his game to survive and thrive in the modern pace and space NBA. You would not have thought that back when he was in his prime with the Nets.
Credit to him for evolving his game. He didn't make a three until his seventh NBA season. He didn't make a three. And even then, he shot 10% from three in that year. During the 16-17 season, he jumped up to 35%. This year, he's shooting 37.5% from three. That's a career high for Brooke Lopez. He can play forever, it feels like. And his go ahead.
No, it does. And I just want to note real quick, because there was this quick interlude between his last season with the Nets when he first started shooting some threes and then his Bucks career, which is now how we think of him. You remember where he was in between? One single season with the Los Angeles Lakers when they had swapped him for D'Angelo Russell. And the Lakers didn't keep him.
That's right. Oh, brutal. Then he went to Milwaukee. He's been Milwaukee ever since and is worth every nickel to the Bucks right now. He's not the 20-point-per-game scorer we saw. He's not the 20-point-per-game scorer we saw in Brooklyn, but like he's every bit as effective. Right now, he's leading the NBA in blocks. He's averaging 2.5 blocks per game right now for Milwaukee. So, remarkable turn for Brooke Lopez, who's been incredibly important to that team's success. All right, let's talk about the Cleveland Cavaliers, who right now are 8-2 after the loss to the Clippers on Monday. It was their first loss since October 19th. They have the NBA's fourth best offense. They've got, as you alluded to earlier, the number two defense. Donovan Mitchell is averaging 31 points per game. Darius Garland is averaging 19. Kevin Love is once again playing really well in this sixth man role. Howard, it feels like before the season, we talked about the Cavs as being maybe a year or two away from being a true contender. This was the year they took a step forward. Maybe they went to the second round of the playoffs, but they were a year away from reaching true contender status. As you look at this team right now, have they reached true contender status? And how much longer do we have to watch until we kind of realize that they might be there?
Yeah, I mean, look, as with everything else, I'm going to use qualifiers when we're this early in the season, right? I don't want to get carried away, and that's not to throw cold water on what the Cavs are doing, because I think my gut is that this is all legit and sustainable, but we are only 10 games into an 82-game season, so I don't want to get too carried away, because there are always going to be some things to do with schedule, to do with injuries, the usual, little ups and downs of a season that are going to change the picture multiple times between now and April. All that said, they're top five in both offensive and defensive efficiency. They are the only team, Chris, that is top five in both offensive and defensive efficiency right now. And if you can sustain that, that charts out to be a contender. If you're top five in both, you're pretty, if you're top 10 in both, you are in the conversation. If you're top five in both, you are in the contender conversation. I did not think, and I said multiple times, probably on this podcast and elsewhere, including on Cleveland Radio, where somebody will have taken note of it, that I thought they will have a good season. They are no better than maybe fifth or sixth in the East, but that's fine. They're on their way up. Don't expect too much too soon just because they got Donovan Mitchell. This team just broke through last year. They've had no success over the last however many decades, minus the LeBron seasons, right? This is the first, this is the best non-LeBron team they've had since like the late 80s, I think. So I thought, don't count too much too soon, in large part too, because of course, you know, their core, their young core, was all under 25. Jared Allen, Evan Mobley, who was just coming off his rookie year, obviously, Darius Garland, these guys are really young. So don't put too much on them, even with Donovan Mitchell having arrived. All that said, look, they do have some good veteran support there, right? You mentioned Kevin Love, you know, another guy who, like we said with Brook Lopez, kind of reinventing himself late in his career, you know, becoming this great sixth man, the only tie back to their championship back in 2016. So you, Kevin Love, obviously a veteran. Caris LeVert's in his late 20s now. He's been around, you know, the league a few rotations. You know, Robin Lopez is hanging out. There's a few others. It's not a real veteran team, but, you know, and then Donovan Mitchell. You know, Donovan Mitchell's already, you know, lived a full lifetime during his Jazz days as the star of that team. So it's possible. It's possible. They were already great defensively last season. The one thing they didn't have was more dynamism to their offense because they just needed another scorer playmaker. They got one of the best in Donovan Mitchell. So give it a little time. But if it were, you know, the proverbial gun to the head, make a prediction now, they're a top four team in the East.
You know, I had one eye on the Clipper game last night as I was watching the Lakers Jazz. And watching the way the Clippers kind of flummoxed Cleveland down the stretch with some of their switching defenses and the way that they were trying to exploit some of the matchups, that showed me that the Cavs have a little bit more to learn. And it's still very early in this season. They can still learn it. But when you go up against veteran experienced teams that have been in the playoffs before, they're going to throw wrinkles at you that you're not entirely used to. All that being said, if the Cavs stay top five in offensive defense, they're a championship contender. It's as simple as that. I'm not surprised that they've improved this much offensively. Donovan Mitchell was a round peg, round hole type of fit. They needed another playmaking guard. Donovan Mitchell, as a playmaking guard, is as good as it gets. He has gravitated towards in this new, or he's thrived rather in this new role with alongside Darius Garland, and I think that's perfectly sustainable on the offensive end. Defensively, I didn't expect them to take this massive step back, but I did expect it to have some slippage this year when they moved Mitchell in and moved guys like Markkanen and others out. I didn't think they'd be able to sustain it in this way. Mitchell last year was not a good defensive player. Now, some of that had to do with the fact that he, you know, look, he I think he even admitted it. He wasn't playing with maximum effort on that end of the floor, and having all the offensive responsibility that he had with the Jazz, that can cost you something on defense. But Mitchell this year has been excellent defensively. He's got a really long wingspan, which I think people forget about when they look at his relatively small size for a two guard. But he has been putting in effort every single possession. He has been grinding, and he has been, you know, if not a plus for that team defensively, at least not a negative for them. So I guess I'm going to be watching their defense all season long, because offensively, I believe they can keep this pace up. They do have the horses to be a really good offensive team. Defensively, can they be that team? Can they continue to shine at this level? I don't know. I mean, that's the variable to me, Howard. What's the thing you're watching for the rest of the season with them?
So, look, they are an undersized backcourt with Mitchell and Garland together, and they've had more games with just Mitchell because Garland, of course, was out injured for quite a bit. And by the way, that's another thing I'm keeping an eye on. One of the things I wondered about before the season started was how long does it take for Garland and Mitchell to find their offensive chemistry as two guys who are both ball dominant and have had the offense in their controls with separate teams. Now they've got to figure out the balance. And it's basically been the Donovan Mitchell show so far. And Darius Garland is young enough, and I think also just, you know, just he's a good guy. Like, Darius Garland is that I think rare young star who a guy like Mitchell comes in and says, you know what? You're more established than I am. This is fine. Like, if the balance is a little bit tilted toward Donovan Mitchell, I don't think Garland minds. And somebody has to, you know, they both have to sacrifice a little, but like somebody has to be the one to say, you know what? It's okay if I'm not the one with the ball in my hands at all the critical times or getting the big shots or whatever. But it's something that you keep an eye on because that's just the natural thing in basketball, right? You do have to find the balance and the chemistry. And it's been simplified early because of Darius Garland being out so much. But they are a small backcourt. Defensively, it was fair to wonder if they'd be a little challenged. On the flip side of it, even if they can't hold their own defensively, they've got maybe the best 4 or 5 defensive combination in the league in Evan Mobley and Jared Allen behind them. That said, I was in Cleveland very briefly during the preseason with SiriusXM NBA Radio to do the camp day, right? And I asked both Garland and Mitchell, like, listen, you don't have a defensive rep as a guard. That's not been your calling card. Can you count on this amazing back line to make you guys elite defensively, or does this call for something different if you guys really want to make that next step? And of course, both of them said, listen, no, they acknowledged it. And Donovan Mitchell, to his credit, he acknowledged, like, and he's like, the advanced stats are not kind to Donovan Mitchell's Utah years. Like, not even average defensively, and not even like a net negative defensively, but like among the worst at his position defensively. And he said, look, I know I've got to work at that end. And I think both of them kind of felt like there's an obligation to not just send everything back to Jared Allen and Evan Mobley. I think so far we've seen the results of that. You just mentioned it. Like, Donovan Mitchell's actually working defensively, and credit to him. Again, guys can still evolve over the course of their careers. We got to give them the room to do that.
Yeah, I agree. Let's finish in Phoenix, Howard, where the Suns right now are 7-3 on the season. They've gotten past a lot of the early season drama with respect to DeAndre Ayton, gotten off to a good start. Devin Booker has played well. Ayton has played well. I look at the Suns, though, and I don't have this overwhelming feeling of optimism like I do with some other teams right now. And maybe still in the back of my mind is what happened in the playoffs last year against Dallas, where a 64-win Suns team went into Game 7 in the conference semifinals and got absolutely bludgeoned. And then the fallout from that was DeAndre Ayton having friction with the organization, having friction with his head coach, Monty Williams. Couple that with Chris Paul is now injured. Cam Johnson is now injured. There are some warning signs at the moment in Phoenix, which kind of brings me to the question I want to ask about the Suns. The Suns were one of the top contenders for Kevin Durant this offseason. That was in part because Durant put Phoenix on his wish list. If the opportunity to acquire Durant comes up again, how aggressive do you think the Suns need to be here? They still have more than enough talent, when healthy, to finish among the top three in the Western Conference. They're just 2 years removed from going to the NBA Finals. But I just get the feeling like without a Durant-like infusion, there are several other teams in the West, I think, that are better than them. Even the ones that don't have as good a record as them right now. How do you feel about Phoenix and its chances moving forward?
There's a single statistic that, to me, is the most critical for the Suns and the one that I would focus on the most. And it's this number, 37. That's Chris Paul's age, Chris. Chris Paul's 37. Chris Paul is the linchpin who made the Suns, along with Monty Williams and some other elements that came into focus a couple seasons ago. But it was Chris Paul who takes his team from the lottery to contender. And if you remove Chris Paul and replace him with replacement level point guard, as great as Devin Booker has been, as talented as Mikal Bridges and DeAndre Ayton are, this is not a contender. So you have a window. Your window is Chris Paul's window until you figure out who comes after Chris Paul. He's 37. Point guards don't generally age as well as Chris Paul has, and it's to his credit that he has. But he does wear down. He does get injured. And sooner or later, you're not going to have him at this level. To answer the question, yeah, all in on Kevin Durant. They have to be. And that might mean waiting until January 15th when DeAndre Ayton is trade eligible again, because if you're the Nets, if you're going to decide to take my advice, as I wrote at length last week, and acknowledge defeat and blow this thing up, if you're the Nets, you probably want the Ayton-Mikhail Bridges combo in addition to as many picks as you can possibly extract and pick swaps. If not that, you know, it was possibly, you know, can you do Bridges and Cam Johnson in some, you know, in the full package of picks? Is that enough for the Nets? You know, who else is bidding for the Nets? What do they offer? I mean, it gets into a whole, you know, on and on discussion about what it takes to get Durant. But the Suns have the means to, I think, get him and still have enough there. They will still have, at minimum, Chris Paul and Devin Booker and you know, at least one of those wings. And who knows, maybe the Nets send them, you know, Claxton or somebody in to replace Ayton if Ayton's in the deal. I don't know. But I don't think the Suns are a contender as like their path requires other teams to have misfortune right now. Like they have a plausible path, but I don't think there's enough firepower there. And we saw that in the playoffs last spring, that sometimes when things, you know, grind to a halt late in the game, they just can't manufacture enough offense. Durant is a cheat code still. And I say you got to be all in for him.
Well, give credit to Chris Paul for beating back Father Time as long as he has. I mean, you go back to 2019, a lot of people thought Chris Paul was done after that last season in Houston. He goes to Oklahoma City, yes, revitalizes the Thunder for 1 year. The last couple of years in Phoenix, he has been excellent. But just looking at the numbers this year, they're way down. His field goal percentage is a career low. His three-point percentage is a career low. He's averaging less than 10 points per game for the first time in his career. Now he's out with a heel injury. It doesn't sound like it's that significant based on his comments from last night, but you do have to wonder exactly what level Chris Paul is going to be for the rest of this season and beyond. Bringing in Kevin Durant makes up for a lot of that, because Durant... Yes. Still an offensive just nightmare. I mean, he is still an unbelievable offensive player. And look, the asking price is going to be pretty steep. DeAndre Ayton, certainly, maybe Mikhail Bridges. But if you're going to give yourself a chance to maximize the last year of Chris Paul's career, or last year or two of Chris Paul's career, to maximize a prime year of Devin Booker, I think you got to roll the dice. Maybe it doesn't work, but look, again, Kevin Durant's under contract for a few more years. Not like you're trading away guys for 1 year of Kevin Durant. You're kind of keeping your window open for two, maybe three more years with Kevin Durant in the mix. I think you got to do it. And look, there's been a lot of talk about how Brooklyn maybe doesn't want DeAndre Ayton. I don't have any like direct, I haven't spoken to anybody directly about this. I just don't buy it. Like, I think the Nets, if they can get their hands on an early 20s, you know, center who has looked great the last couple of years, who helped take a team to the finals 2 years ago, I think they'll do it. And Mikhail Bridges, one of the best defensive wings in the NBA. I'm not sure if you even need a whole bunch of draft picks back in return if you get those two guys in a trade. So I think for both teams, with the way the Nets are trending and where the Suns are right now, a Kevin Durant deal just makes a lot of sense for both sides. I just feel that way. I feel pretty strongly that way.
Yeah, no, for sure. And if the Nets decide to go this path, if they, because look, as you and I record this on Tuesday morning, for all we know, Kyrie Irving and Adam Silver are meeting literally as we speak. I don't know what's next for Kyrie Irving, but as I wrote last week, I do know this. Kyrie Irving's not going to be a Net next season. So you're either cutting ties with him via trade, waive, sending him home, whatever it is. I don't know what the Nets, you know, I'm not saying any, you know, it's justified to cut him either. I'm not making that case. I'm just saying the Nets are clearly reaching a breaking point here with Kyrie Irving. And I don't know what his fate is. I do know for sure this much. He will not be a Brooklyn Net next season. They came here in tandem, Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. Durant might be happy still without him, but you have to replace him. You need another star. That's not Ben Simmons right now and might never be. And I don't know where they're getting that other guy. And Kevin Durant is also late in his career. So what are you doing? Why is Kevin Durant still here? And Kevin Durant issued a trade demand just a few months ago, then retracted it when it looked like there was no deal in the works. But it doesn't mean he's any less unsettled about where the Nets are. And it's going to be even more so now because Kyrie Irving is done. You know, their best case scenario is that Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant play out the rest of the season with the Nets, that Ben Simmons finds some semblance of his old game. And even if all that happens, they're still not making it probably past the second round. I don't even know if they're making it out of the first round. So they're done. This whole experiment is over. This is what I wrote last week. And as soon as they come to that conclusion, and I think they have to, then they'll make Kevin Durant available. I think that, I believe that that's coming. Right now, they seem like they're trying a different path. They want to squeeze out every possible ounce of success this season. But we know it's over after this season. So what are you really playing for? What are you waiting for? And if they make that move, Chris, here's the thing. Phoenix will be able to make strong pitches, as you and I just discussed, but so will Toronto. I don't know if Miami finds a way to get into this. I don't know if the Lakers maybe make a run at Durant. I don't even know how that works, unless the Nets just really want those two future Laker picks. I don't know if the Pelicans would engage with their incredible cache of picks, plus they've got good players. But the Nets will, you know, I don't know if the Suns are a lock to get him, in other words, like if they get into this. They absolutely should be in the running, but it'll be interesting to see what the market looks like once this goes that path.
See, we almost made it an entire podcast without talking about the Nets, but there you go, you know, railing on, banging on about Kyrie Irving
You brought up Kevin Durant.
I did. What am I going to do? You took it straight into the deep dive on the Nets.
I just want to plug my story again. It's completely out of self-interest.
Check out Howard's stories on the Nets up on SI.com. Check out my stuff on the Lakers up on SI.com as well. Howard, good stuff, man. We will do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Everybody go vote.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.